Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, escalating rhetoric on North Korea.
They will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Is it reminiscent of the careful calculus of Cold War brinkmanship or irresponsible escalation? Also today, two views on the so-called Massachusetts boycott bill, which proponents say would prohibit discrimination in state contracts. Opponents think it would stifle free speech. And in sports...
Well, it's a clean start. It's a good start by Coleman. The Americans flying in lane number five. It's the American leading the Jamaican at the moment.
A shocking defeat as Usain Bolt ends his historic career. Plus our new series, Authors on Authors, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Megan Marshall on her favorite books of the summer. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's start by getting up to speed on all that's happened on North Korea. First, there was President Trump's bellicose statement yesterday.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
And to remind you, Trump's remarks came in response to reports that North Korea had created a warhead small enough to fit on top of one of its intercontinental ballistic missiles. Nevertheless, despite Donald Trump's remarks, North Korea did indeed make a threat, saying it is considering a missile strike on the U.S. territory of Guam. And earlier today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made his way back from a trip to Southeast Asia, and here's what he told reporters.
What the president was doing is sending a strong message to North Korea in language that Kim Jong-un would understand, because he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language.
But Tillerson also urged calm, if not in Washington and Pyongyang, then in the rest of America.
I think Americans should sleep well at night, have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days.
However, other members of the Trump administration today continued with the apocalyptic language. Defense Secretary James Mattis issued a written statement saying North Korea should, quote, cease any consideration of actions that would lead to the end of its regime and destruction of its people. So what's really going on here? I mean, is this a careful bit of calculated rhetoric, a return to brinkmanship in order to get North Korea to bend, or is it just reckless escalation? To help us sort through this, Kathy Moon. She's a professor of political science at Wellesley College and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so how do you characterize what we've been hearing from the Trump administration in the past couple of days? Is it, as Rex Tillerson has said, language that Kim Jong-un understands?
Well, to me, it sounds like two bullies duking it out through words. And in truth, when we're dealing with nuclear weapons and a very difficult state such as North Korea, we should not be taking the bully strategy. We should be having a much more, we the United States should be having a much clearer sense of what is possible as an ultimate goal. And frankly, denuclearization, which is the U.S. policy, the end goal in terms of dealing with North Korea, which has been consistent under Trump, Obama, Bush, and Clinton, this no longer works. Mm. It could have worked up until the last leader, Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader, Kim Jong-un. However, this young guy leading North Korea will not denuclearize, period.
So before we get deeper into sort of what options are, what diplomatic options are on the Korean Peninsula, let me just ask you, When the president of the United States, and particularly this president, Donald Trump, says the kinds of things he says, I mean, I'm seeing reports now that other officials are saying that Trump's fire and fury remarks were off the cuff, really. And, we have these other statements coming from other parts of the administration seeming to try to, like, temper the reaction. But regarding Trump himself and his statements, I mean, how much weight do they carry or how much how do the North Koreans, how does Kim Jong-un hear those things?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think this is where the bully language is an appropriate framework to understand what's going on. Trump has the bully personality, and he's using this language to another bully, Mr. Kim of North Korea. The question is, does Kim take Trump seriously? And my answer would be not so much. Why? He's no different from any other leader around the world who has not been taking Mr. Trump seriously because too much comes out of Mr. Trump's mouth and tweets that are confusing, contradictory, and they're actually very counterproductive for the U.S. government, the administration, his administration. My concern about this kind of this phrasing of fire and fury is not so much that it would escalate and make the North Koreans more explosive in their behavior, but that it really sends mixed signals to our own government.
Mm.
So, for example, the State Department, many people do not know this, but the State Department is very quietly, through back channels, has been pursuing efforts at diplomatic dialogue with North Korea. So North Korean diplomats and American diplomats actually have been trying for months to see if they can come up with an agreement to begin talks. When Mr. Trump says these kinds of things, it can really confuse the various parties. Is the U.S. government serious about productive, constructive, peaceful talks or not? And then also, what is the State Department supposed to do? Pursue
right.
this kind of an effort, which is actually sanctioned by the White House, or not? There's even some rumor that the Dennis Rodman visit of last month, right, the secret visit that was supposed to be private just on the part of Dennis Rodman. I've heard that people in Washington who, quote, are in the know think that that Dennis Rodman might have had the green light from Trump.
Huh.
So what is all this if he's talking one way and then action is another way?
So that's what's going on at the State Department. And I should note that we still have no nominee for ambassador to South
Absolutely.
Korea. We also don't have any nominee for the undersecretaries
and assistant secretary
for non-proliferation for
right.
East Asian affairs. I mean, the State Department's kind of got a skeletal staff right now, for especially in these key positions. But over at the Defense Department, what position does this put someone like James Mattis in? Because if I remember correctly, he's consistently said that military action on the Korean Peninsula would be catastrophic.
See, this is what's curious, because Mattis was believed to be one of the very few people who knew what's going on and who is going to keep a level head on North Korea and every other security problem and help Mr. Trump understand what politics, international politics, is really about. So when Mr. Mattis starts changing his rhetoric or his words, I think it would make people nervous. On the other hand, he's got to hold on to his job. So I don't know if this is just basically kissing up to Mr. Trump or if he really has a policy change.
Right. Well, and in his statement, he also pointed out, this is Secretary Mattis saying that Kim Jong-un should take heed of the UN Security Council's unified voice, referring to that vote, that 15-0 vote on sanctions a couple of days ago. And then Mattis goes on to say that, and statements from government the world over who agree that North Korea poses a threat to global security and stability. So a nod there to diplomatic efforts and
right,
sanctions as
right,
well.
Right. But I think the problem is that when Mr. Trump speaks this way, it is not just North Korea who is the audience. It's our allies and friends in the East Asia region, as well as other parts of the world. So Japan, South Korea, and China, how do they interpret Mr. Trump's words? These words, on the one hand, people find hard to take seriously because he has been changing his rhetoric, his public rhetoric about North Korea. He would be honored to meet Kim Jong-un, he once said. He would be happy to have a hamburger with Kim Jong-un, he said another time. On the other hand, he now says fire and fury, like the world has never seen. So these are very conflicting messages, and it does not help allies and friends figure out what our strategy is.
So China, a hugely important player in this puzzle, right? I mean, because on the one hand, perhaps the Chinese government sees North Korea as a buffer between it and U.S. influence vis-a-vis South Korea. On the other hand, China also is what? The main supplier of oil to North Korea, trade, food, et cetera. I mean, is it not in China's long-term best interest to have a denuclearized Korean peninsula?
Yes, it is in China's long-term best interest. But I think for China, there are several things that often get missed. It's not just about a buffer state. It's also that China has contractual treaty obligations to North Korea to defend North Korea. They are allies, and we often forget that. So they have to dance a very fine line between trying to work with the rest of the international community and with the United States and still acknowledging that they have a military alliance. They have an ally alliance, formal alliance with the DPRK. Number two is that China has said for the last 20 or so years since the George W. Bush administration that China is not does not hold the key to North Korea.
They've said that.
And
but is
you
that
know
necessarily
what?
True?
Yes, I do believe that. And this is the one thing that I wish people would have taken more seriously, because China never wanted to be put in this position, never wanted to be the one who has to be this mediator. That's one thing. The other thing is, even if China were to squeeze North Korea so hard, the question is, would the North Korean regime kowtow to China or to the rest of the world and say, we give up? And my answer is no. And nobody talks about what will happen to North Korea. Why would North Korea succumb? Okay, if they're going to go hungry, they'll let their people go hungry.
That has happened before.
That has happened before. If they have to use the most anachronistic sets of military armaments to prove whatever point they make, they will. It may not be nuclear, but they have conventional weapons that are antiquated, but they work. So North Korea is not a country, is not a state that is going to kowtow to China. North Korea actually looks down on China at times. And the third point, which a lot of people don't think about, is that Beijing, Xi Jinping, does not actually have full control over all of this humongous landmass called China, including the bureaucracy. He fights every day for control over this territory. Northeast Asia, that is adjacent to North Korea, Northeast China, rather, that's adjacent to North Korea, has very thick economic ties that are not just about supply line to the north.
Right.
The Chinese in the Northeast benefit. So there is a regional economy there that has integrated North Korea into its everyday livelihood. And so for the Northeast Chinese to give up that integration, in a sense, that's what they're trying to fight against,
right,
in terms of Beijing.
So this, I mean, honestly, this detailed look at the Chinese perspective is absolutely fascinating to me. And I would love to have you back to talk about it more, because they are a major player in this challenge facing us. But before I let you go, I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is also extraordinarily important. I mean, you were saying that for the past many U.S. administrations, the end goal has been denuclearizing North Korea. And you said you don't think that that is possible anymore. That is not a realistic end goal.
No.
If that is indeed the case, I mean, one could say the nuclear genie is out of the bottle in North Korea, then what are the United States' options? I mean, is it containment? Is it war? What is it? Because the threat is real.
Yes, the threat is real, and it's escalating, and I don't foresee any conflagration happening, but accidents can happen. Unintended violence can happen. What the U.S. faces is a problem between North Korean capabilities and intentions and an anachronistic, outdated U.S. policy strategy called denuclearization. The North doesn't want to talk as long as denuclearization is on the table and is the goal of the United States.
But then we have a stalemate, right? Because the United States won't say anything other
than
denuclearization.
Well, that's partly our problem. We need to, I think, really think hard and, in a way, face the reality and suck it up that this is a fully nuclear state. We treat North Korea and Washington, D.C. as a de facto nuclear state. We don't have to say, hey, welcome to the nuclear club, but we could work toward arms control and disarmament, which is a different framework which acknowledges that it is a nuclear state, and actually try to get some diplomatic headway on that level, but also with economic goodies. We never spelled out to the North Koreans in any detail what kind of specific economic benefits would come to them if they were to open up to the world, and they don't have to denuclearize to do that. And that's what they want. They want to keep their nuclear program and to grow their economy. And they're doing both quite well.
Well, that's a sobering reality check, Professor Moon, you're offering us. But I hazard to say that I don't think the political reality at the time is
Congress,
beneficial to that outcome.
And Congress is really the institution that would say no more than the White House or any other institution.
Well, Kathy Moon is professor of political science at Wellesley College and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, time for state politics. So let's talk about a proposed bill on Beacon Hill, one that's generating quite a bit of controversy. It's called an Act Prohibiting Discrimination in State Contracts. And here's what it would do. It would require any person or business seeking a state contract of more than $10,000 to certify that they're in compliance with Massachusetts anti-discrimination law. Well, the bill finds itself at the nexus of a heated debate over Israel, the Palestinian people, and the right to boycott. A similar debate in a variety of proposed legislation is also going on in some 30 other states. And there's a federal bill with even clearer goals. That one's called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act and could include some criminal prosecution. Now, proponents in this state, in Massachusetts, note that this state's proposal makes no mention of Israel or the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But opponents argue that the bill infringes on free speech. So we're going to get both views about this legislation today, and we'll begin with Aaron Ogolnik. He's the Director of Government Affairs at the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Boston, a group that supports the bill. Aaron, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, tell me, why do you and the Jewish Community Relations Council believe that Massachusetts needs this law?
So we became involved in this bill because we were hearing that Israelis, and in particular Israeli business owners here in the Commonwealth, were feeling targeted based solely on who they are in terms in the business arena. So while looking through our state's procurement laws, we noticed that there was a loophole of sorts that existed where there are laws that disallow discrimination in various areas, but in terms of the opposite side of the business relationship in terms of the sellers versus buyers, there was nothing really that protected business owners from being targeted for who they were.
Business owners here in the Commonwealth?
Yes. So what I mean by that is that there are current anti-discrimination laws which exist.
Right.
And as we know, those apply in housing, employment, and public accommodations. So if you hold yourself open as a business, you cannot refuse to serve someone or hire someone, or you can't fire someone based on their inherent characteristics. But what there is no protection for is if you as a business owner or a contractor of the state say, I will not do business with for instance, Israeli business owner, as of right now, there is no current protection for that business owner, and the state is powerless to do anything in that circumstance.
So some people who are concerned about this bill say that they don't feel, what they feel the bill does is that it equates discrimination based on national origin, which is definitely problematic, with it's that it, that they fear it equates that with political protest against the actions of a state, which is different. I mean, what's your response to that?
Certainly, and I think that we agree with that. We think that there are lines where political boycotts are very different, but the distinction is when you turn a political boycott against a foreign government or the actions of somebody, but then begin to twist it into taking it out on who somebody is. That's where this line of a political boycott becomes very hazy and becomes really subject to discrimination. So, for instance, in the context of the Israel-Palestinian debate, a boycott against the Israeli government, this bill has nothing to do with that. The boycott of a company that does something or its actions, this bill does nothing to do with that. But when that boycott starts moving against and starts targeting Israelis solely for the fact that they're Israeli, we find that to be something that is potentially problematic.
But how could you determine that? You know, like how can you determine that intent?
So like all anti-discrimination laws, a lot of it comes down to the intent of the individual. Mm-hmm. So all of them, you have to look at the facts and circumstances. And what we've seen across the country and even here in the Commonwealth, where different municipalities have created tougher regulations within their own individual procurement codes that go beyond the state's anti-discrimination laws, that there haven't really been enforcements because in large part it creates a deterrent effect, not a deterrent effect on engaging in free speech, but a deterrent effect on determining, is this crossing the line? When does it cross the line? When is it legitimate? And all this bill does is says that the Commonwealth should be neutral. And if a situation rises to the level of where foreign nationals or citizens here within the United States of a background should be targeted, then the state should act, as it has acted in many, many different areas.
Right. This is so interesting because the role that the state should or shouldn't play in these issues is a compelling and complicated question, because another way of looking at it is that in the past, Massachusetts or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has actually actively inserted itself in questions of boycotts. For example, I mean, I'm looking at this. These are some dates that come from a recent op-ed that appeared in the Boston Globe, that back in 1982, Massachusetts enacted a different law that ended investment of public pension funds in firms doing business in South Africa, right? With apartheid South Africa. They did something similar in 1996 when the legislature passed a law boycotting the state of Myanmar, aka Burma, because of its pervasive human rights abuses. And at the city level, just last year, about a bit over a year ago, the city council voted unanimously to boycott the state of North Carolina because of its, you know, so-called bathroom bill. So that's the other side of the coin here, that when it comes to issues or regimes that the state feels don't align with the values of Massachusetts, they've had no problem with supporting boycotts.
Right, exactly. And that is the exact point that we're making here, is that who should determine where that line draws?
But it almost seems as if the state would be in violation of its own law if this bill passes.
Oh, no. Well, that's a good point. However, in the bill, and I always encourage people, especially when there's a heated debate, to read the bill. I'm not suggesting yourself, of course.
I have read it.
Of course you have.
I got both copies right here because it's actually really short. It's just two pages long.
It's a short bill. It is what it is. It says what it says. But in fact, within that bill is language that says if there is state law or federal law that in essence requires you to discriminate based on national origin, then that would not put you in conflict with this law. So in essence, the citation of those examples, which there's a good reason why those are the examples, are the times where the state has said, these are the examples that cross the line. This is where we should act. And all this bill is doing is saying that the state, as a market participant, has a right to express its own views. And this state has a very, very strong policy of non-discrimination. We stand at the forefront of extending protections to as many people as we possibly can. This bill mirrors that exact situation. All it does is says that you cannot, if you decide you want to hold someone accountable based on who they are and not anything that they've done, the state is not going to subsidize that type of discrimination. That's what the bill does.
Well, Aaron Agolnick is the Director of Government Affairs at the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Boston, and they support this proposed legislation currently on Beacon Hill. Aaron, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Well, let's turn now and get a different perspective on this. We have Liza Berendt. She's on the line. She's a member of Jewish Voice for Peace Boston and the Massachusetts Freedom to Boycott Coalition. They represent some 60 activist organizations that oppose this proposed legislation. Liza, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you. Let me just get right to one major question that Great. Aaron raised, and which is why should the Commonwealth effectively, by granting contracts to companies or individuals that may choose to boycott Israeli companies, why should the Commonwealth be subsidizing another group's political speech or decisions?
So this bill, this anti-boycott bill, its supporters are basing their argument on a fundamental misconception about what boycotts of Israel actually look like and are actually happening here in Massachusetts. So Palestinians called in 2005 for people of conscience around the world to engage in a variety of economic pressure, so boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, on the state of Israel and entities that are directly complicit in Israeli violence against Palestinians, until Israel respects basic international law and human rights premises. So something that's really key to this strategy is that BDS activists target institutions. They target corporations, universities, major institutions that are directly complicit in violence.
But you heard
there's
what...
There's actually not a single example of an Israeli individual in Massachusetts or anywhere that I know of who has been targeted for their identity.
Well, forgive me for interrupting you a little bit earlier, but I mean, is there not the danger, though, that under the guise of political boycott, that folks could end up being unfairly targeted as individuals?
I mean, sure, anyone can use a moral political campaign as a guise for their own personal biases, but Massachusetts law already protects that. A number of leading constitutional lawyers from Harvard Law School, Columbia Law School, and some major civil rights law organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, have all come out with statements saying that this bill actually does not offer any new protections for individuals who are discriminated against based on their identity. So the Israeli individuals who Mr. Agolnick is referencing, whoever they are, would already be protected by discrimination law, and companies that choose not to do business with them based on their identity already would not be able to contract with the state. What we have here is an attempt to silence Palestinian grassroots nonviolent activists who are asking for basic respect and dignity, and their allies who are fighting for justice in the tradition of some of the wonderful movements you referenced just now, the boycotts of Myanmar and Burma, boycotts of South Africa, boycotts of North Carolina based on its anti-LGBT bias.
Well, if I could just jump in here, I mean, I clearly hear a difference of opinion between you and Aaron Agolnick about whether or not there's a loophole in state law, and we can't necessarily come to a complete clarification on that. And listeners, I'm sorry, we'll keep trying, but let me ask you, if I may, I still want to get to this question of what role should the state be playing when it comes to political expression through the form of a boycott, for example, because on the one hand, I know you and other groups say that this proposal has the potential to chill speech, but as we heard from Aaron Agolnick, he says the thing that it would chill is discriminatory conduct, which perhaps the state should be trying to, do what it can to chill discriminatory conduct.
Sure. Yeah. And again, the state already does that. So I should say I'm not a lawyer. So these legal arguments that I'm making are conclusions I've drawn from a set of statements from constitutional lawyers and civil rights organizations. But boycott is a is protected by the First Amendment, and this was stated in the 1982 Supreme Court's case, Claiborne Hardware versus NAACP. It's a constitutionally protected right. And it is against the law for the state to force a contractor to give up a constitutionally protected right as a condition of a state contract. So it is indeed unconstitutional to say we won't contract with you because of political positions you are taking. And I also want to say, because there are many questions about how this bill would actually be enforced, whether or not it is enforced, and no matter how it is enforced, the intent of this bill counts. And the intent is to silence Palestinian people who are simply asking for equal rights, and to intimidate people of conscience in Massachusetts who might otherwise want to support them and take their money out of Israeli violence against Palestinians.
Well, we'll have to see what happens to this bill as it progresses through Beacon Hill. But Liza, just one last question for you. Do you think there's any common ground between you and other groups whom you're allied with and folks who are in support of the bill when it comes to, you know, coming, again, finding some common ground when it comes to opposing discrimination in state contracts?
That's a great question. I think that Mr. Ogulnik and I, everyone who is speaking out for or against this bill, cares very deeply about stopping discrimination in Massachusetts and working towards a just peace in Palestine, Israel. What troubles me is that there are some legislators who see the situation in Palestine right now, where, you know, Palestinians are living under a completely different set of laws. You know, they are not allowed to drive on the same streets. They are not allowed to enter communities where Israelis live. People in Gaza have their electricity cut off for 22 hours a day right now because Israel is controlling the utilities for millions of people, and it's a terrible humanitarian crisis. And there are certain legislators who, instead of saying, how can we foster a commonwealth where progressive activists and change makers can work together to come up with productive next steps to work for international peace? Mm-hmm. They want to silence Palestinians who care about this and are working to make nonviolent, peaceful change.
Well, Liza, if I may just jump in here. Sorry, I'm just out of time for this segment. That's Liza Barrett. She's a member of the Massachusetts Freedom to Boycott Coalition and also of Jewish Voice for Peace Boston. She and her group and many others oppose the so-called boycott bill on Beacon Hill right now. Liza, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
And a little bit earlier, we heard from Aaron Ogulnik. He's Director of Government Affairs at the Jewish Community Relations Council of Boston. They are in support of the bill currently pending on Beacon Hill. We'll see what happens. I have a feeling that this is a conversation we will return to. So thank you both so much for joining us. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and yes, it is Wednesday, so time for sports. Joining us now to discuss is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hi, Shira.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so let's just start with this.
For one last time, Usain Bolt settles in his blocks over the 100-meter distance.
Well, it's a clean start. It's a good start by Coleman. The American's flying in lane number five. It's the American leading the Jamaican at the moment. It's going to be Coleman, but on the outside in lane number eight, unofficially 9.94 seconds. Well, was it Gatlin in lane number eight?
It's not that often we can play an entire sporting event, but that was it. The 100-meter sprint on Sunday at the World Athletic Championships. What happened? Was it Gatlin?
It was Justin Gatlin and Usain Bolt, the most electrifying figure to date in track and field. came in third.
Shocking.
Absolutely shocking.
Really? And I mean, this was no pun intended, like really shocking.
Really shocking. I mean, this was supposed to be his grand finale of a tremendous career where he was supposed to walk off, you know, with the winner's laurels, but he didn't.
It's still hard to believe, and especially given who beat him, right? I mean, Justin Gatlin has more than a checkered career.
Yeah, Justin Gatlin is twice been sort of convicted or suspended for doping, and he's not well liked. What you didn't hear in that were the boos that rained down from the stands in London after he won, and there were boos again at his medal ceremony. Because he is not a well-liked figure in the track and field world. He was suspended twice, as I mentioned, and including one time for 4 years. So that's a pretty major suspension. And they don't know what sort of the residual, the long-term effects of doping, you know, is. So maybe he's still benefiting in some small way from the drugs that he was given earlier in his career. And there's a real sort of ethical problem many athletes have and many fans have with him competing. And also you have this division, right? You have Usain Bolt, who's kind of rejuvenated the sport, kind of made people forget a little bit about doping.
Yeah.
And then this marred his what was supposed to be his retirement party.
Right. And he came in third, right?
He came in third. Yeah. I mean, it's shocking as Usain Bolt losing a race is. There were some signs. You know, he had some back problems. He also is a horrible starter. It's sort of weird to say that about the world record holder. But, you know, he is known for his late race surges.
Yeah,
and, you know, he just couldn't make up a poor start. And it's sad. It's sad to see him go out like that. I mean, he handled it graciously, but it's sad. It's sad to see the career end like
totally.
That.
Totally. Yes, it's sad because it was his last official
I'm sad. And I was there at the beginning. Like, I was there at the beginning when he came on the scene in the 2008
Olympics. We may be sad today or this week, but you know, people for a generation are going to look back and just and see the highlights of man's ridiculously amazing career.
I mean, ridiculously amazing is the perfect way to describe it. I mean, this is a guy who set world records by letting up before the finish
and checking out
exactly mugging for the cameras.
Right.
I mean, this is a guy who basically could beat the competition and not seem to try all that hard to do it.
Yeah, and there was a recent article, was it, I can't remember, New York Times, that talked about he even has an awkward gait.
Yeah, he
does. Unconventional gait.
He's unconventional in a lot of ways. Just he has this outgoing personality, which isn't often common for sprinters. He has this unusual gait. And he's just this ebullient person that you don't see it often. He's a rare, rare, rare kind of guy. And he's tall. I mean, that was the other kind of outlier thing. Most of these sprinters are really compact, muscular guys.
And he has an awesome name.
Okay. And he has the perfect name. The perfect name, right?
All right. Well, since we're talking about Usain Bolt and most of us first heard of him when he ran in the Olympic Games, there are some other Olympic sports, I understand, or potential Olympic sports we should be talking about for
Paris?
2024.
Yeah, Paris is considering e-sports or competitive video gaming.
No.
Like, you're rolling your eyes, and so am I, right?
You've got to be kidding.
I'm not kidding. You know, listen, this is a sport that's generated like $400 or $500 million in revenue. It has something like a global audience of 320 million. I mean, it's ridiculously popular in certain pockets, but I don't know how you feel about this, Magna. To me, it's not a sport.
I usually I try to find ways to push back against guests, but I am not pushing back.
Good,
here.
Good. I mean,
look, here's what I have to say. Video gaming, definitely people are making professions out of it. It's hugely popular, as you said.
It
lots
takes
of
talent,
money.
Right?
It takes talent, takes practice. I get that. But to me, the Olympics are about athletic ability. It's a test of the body, not so much of hand-eye coordination through a controller.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I also think, you know, so we're laughing and having a fun conversation about this, but the reality is it also sort of dilutes the Olympic brand. I think more and more when you kind of pull in these sports like swimming or rock climbing or whatever you have, or even some of the extreme sports that they've been pulling in lately to both the Winter and Summer Games, it's kind of like, what is the Olympics all about? You know,
you're a super traditionalist.
I
have no problem with rock climbing being an Olympic
really?
Sport.
No,
really?
I mean, and listen, I know that there once upon a
that's
time
that's physical effort.
Yeah, once upon a time there was tug of war in the Olympics. I get that, you know, the games have evolved and should continue to evolve. I'm all for that. But, you know, at some point you just got to say no. No.
Well, so maybe the bigger issue is it's a fundamental problem with the Olympic Games right now, that there's something lacking in them that makes them have to seek out new things to make it more popular.
Exactly. I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. There
Finally.
Is a fundamental problem with the Olympic Games, and they're trying to figure out a way to solve it, to get younger audiences, to get more money. but I don't think esports is the way.
All right. Well, Shira Springer is WBUR sports and society reporter, including all sports except esports, maybe, today.
I will not be covering any esports anytime soon.
Everyone, what's your Twitter? What's your Twitter, Shira?
At Shira Springer.
Yeah, send your complaints to her.
I was like, should I even say this aloud? What are you setting me up for? Boom.
Shiragate 2017. Yes, yes. Thanks so much, Shira.
Great.
All right. Well, summer's still going on, but we're looking towards the end of it. So nevertheless, we want to take a look at the books you should read while the weather stays good. And who better to ask about favorite books than some of our favorite authors? So today we're going to start a new series, and we're going to do this series for the summer and into the fall, where we ask writers about the best books that they are reading. We're calling it Authors on Authors. And to kick us off today is Pulitzer Prize winner Megan Marshall. She was recently in our studio to talk about her latest book, Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. Today, she's here to talk about what she's reading. So Megan Marshall, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, to you, what epitomizes a summer book?
Well, I'm very lucky that I have the semester off from teaching in the fall. I really can read. I'm not spending the whole summer preparing for classes. A summer book is one that you dive into and you just can't get out of it, like a great swimming pool or a warm lake.
Yeah.
And the first one I want to mention is one that I didn't even know existed, although it's a reprint, Jan Morris's Conundrum, a memoir of her childhood, her early adulthood, through until middle age when she transformed from James Morris, male journalist, to Jan Morris,
oh, I see. Okay.
Journalist and essayist. And, you know, I'd been thinking about, as we all are, the really difficult issues facing transgender people now, and recalling from the early 70s this man who had become a woman really without so much fuss as we're experiencing now.
Yeah, because the book was first published in 1974.
A memoir in 1974. Jan Morris was born in 1926. At age 3, she says her first memory was that she'd been sitting under the piano, her mother was playing the piano, and she had this sense that suddenly this realization that she had been born into the wrong body and should really be a girl. That was James Morris. And it took until 1972 for her to have this change. Now, you think she was born in 1926, age 3, 1929, the Depression, whatever. There was just not any kind of science or medical capability for making this change. And she felt very isolated by this as a child, but still living in an upper crust family in England, going to a choir school among boys.
Yeah.
Being in the cavalry after World War II.
Everything you're describing, it's the prototypical, very restricted gender roles one would think
exactly. of. Exactly. And that was very much her experience. But she felt all the time as if really she was a woman there or a girl and kind of lucky to be invited into this world, eavesdropping. And in fact, perhaps that's why she became a journalist, to have this kind of witness to history. She went and, you know, was there for the first ascent of Mount Everest, wrote about that. But
I understand you have an excerpt you want to read
to
us?
Yeah, well, just a few wonderful passages. You know, she never questioned the rightness of this sense about herself. If it was impossible, then the definition of possibility was inadequate.
Hmm.
But later, you know, writing about what it was like once she had first began taking hormones and dressing in her daily life as a woman, she'd been a member of a men's club. Now she couldn't go there anymore. But she says, nonetheless, it was like stepping from cheap theater into reality, to pass from the ludicrous goings-on of minister's office or ambassador's study, that's the kind of place where she was working as a journalist, into the private house behind, where women were to be found doing real things, like bringing up children. I began to feel that the private part of any life was the only part that mattered.
Huh.
This is a beautiful book. It's not all about these issues. In fact, she says that, you know, this conundrum that faced her was, in her mind, a subject far wider than sex. It was about the escape from maleness into womanhood.
Well, how does she write about how the London and the UK of that time in the mid-1970s reacted to her transitioning?
Well, you know, there were some people who, I guess I should explain that she had married soon out of college, had children, and had explained to her wife privately, you know, that this, the sense of herself as being a woman. So, you know, she had a very conventional life in many ways, but that was just, you know, eating away at her, the sense that it was the wrong life to be living. But, you know, there was a lot of politesse, I guess we could say. She writes moving passages about going out to dinner in the very club in which she had once been a member. Now she could no longer belong, and being treated with the kind of deference, I guess she calls it a sort of subtle deference, subtle subjection of women that she's beginning to realize when she's entered that life. But no way was she going back.
Oh, interesting. Well, you're listening to Megan Marshall. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and she's helping us kick off a series that we've got going here at Radio Boston called Authors on Authors, and she just told us about Conundrum by Jan Morris. And Megan, you've got another suggested great read here, The Weight of Ink.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Great new novel by Rachel Kadish, who's a Boston writer. This summer, there's been a bounty of novels by women in Boston, Julia Glass, Allegra Goodman, Claire Massoud, they all have new books. But Rachel Kadish is someone you might not have heard about before. She spent 12 years on this book, which is one of these kind of amazing feats of combining two plots, a historical plot based in London, a small fledgling Jewish community.
In the 17th century,
In the 17th century, in the time of the plague. There's a young woman there who happens, her name is Esther Velazquez, who's come over from Amsterdam to work as the scribe for a rabbi who was blinded in the Inquisition. And there's this trove of manuscripts that she leaves behind, full of clues and intrigue that a contemporary duo come across, an aging professor of Jewish studies who's about to retire. She's got Parkinson's, so she has to hire this young boy. Her name is Helen Watt, and she hires young Aaron Levy, an American graduate student, to help her with these papers because her Parkinson's she's afraid she's going to ruin these delicate documents by turning the pages. So they're working at this together, and these three characters go through this kind of mystery. It's really one of these great sort of literary intellectual mysteries. And at the heart of it is this Esther Velazquez, who's just a powerful character. Here's just a brief few sentences from when the rabbi allows her to go out into London, the streets of London, where a woman wouldn't normally be traveling about on her own by foot, particularly a Jewish woman in 1660, whenever that is. And she's gone to pick up some books for him. But what he doesn't know, or she thinks he doesn't know, is that she's also beginning to write on her own to some of the great rebellious Jewish thinkers like Spinoza at the time. So she says, somewhere across this bridge beckoning her were books that would be hers to explore and question, and yes, argue against. For in her new daring, now nothing seemed impossible, and she allowed herself to admit even this, that she thought the sages scant in their exploration of what she most wished to understand, the will that set the world in motion and governed it.
Wow.
So she's a rebel in many ways.
So, Megan, let me ask you, you have written terrific books about other literary and historic figures, about Elizabeth Bishop, Margaret Fuller, the Peabody sisters. I mean, what is it about the way that Rachel Kadish sort of uses fiction to do something similar, talk about history
well,
and literature
what's
that you
remarkable,
like?
And this book is very much like perhaps my favorite novel of all time, A.S. Byatt's Possession, where Byatt and here Kadish have created this whole structure of a history that really never happened. I mean, you get all these letters, poems in the case of Byatt. You know, you feel very much as if you're sifting through these documents yourself.
Yeah.
And it's the best aspect of biography, I think, and of fiction as well, to feel that you're kind of making the story, involved in the story. Sometimes the reader knows more than the particular character who's at issue. Sometimes you know less and you're guessing too. It's just a very immersive, great summer or winter read.
That sounds terrific. It's called The Weight of Ink. Now, we've got about a minute-ish or so. Can we get one more in
here? Okay, briefly, you know, I started reading Dori Ashton's The New York School, a book that came out in 1972. Dori Ashton was a brilliant art critic who died this past fall. I started reading it actually during those dark days after the election in November, and I was interested. There have been a number of exhibits of women in abstract expressionism. There's a great one at the DeCordova right now at the MoMA in New York, one traveling one in Colorado and California. But, you know, this is a woman critic, and this book is mostly about men, Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock, de Kooning, Stuart Davis, Robert Motherwell. But she was part of this world. She wrote as an insider and wrote for The Times and then started writing these great books. So here's just a brief passage about how the Depression, the crash of the 30s, led to this movement.
Yeah, just got a little tiny bit of time.
An artist in New York would have seen his place, so cherished for its anarchic vitality during the preceding years, turn overnight into a quiet warren of dying spirits. The physical pangs of hunger were not nearly so great as the psychological shock that hurtled even the most thoughtful Americans into unprecedented confusion.
Wow. Well, that is Megan Marshall reading an excerpt of The New York School by Dori Ashton. Megan is helping us kick off our late summer series we're calling Authors on Authors. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been a real pleasure, and these books sound terrific.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me,
Magna. Well, that's it for today. Listen more for Authors on Authors as the summer progresses, but I'll let you go now. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.